Hey guys, Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps. Head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey, I'm Steph, and this is Not Today. Hello and welcome. Before we jump in, I wanted to let you know that bonus episode number 53 is out now, and our poll for our next bonus episode will be coming out soon. So if you want to vote on the stories you want to hear and get access to 53 extra bonus episodes, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. But today, I'm going to be diving into a very dark case about a family that was terrorized by the man who was supposed to love and care for them the most. Not only was Bisham Sugrim abusing his family, but he also had other dark secrets. He was responsible for 2 murders, and if anyone found out, his family would have to answer for it. This case contains graphic details that may be distressing to some. Listener discretion is advised. Bernadette Hyde was 16 years old when she first met Bisham Sugrim, who she called Brian. It was summertime, and she was going over to her cousin's house to pick him up to go swimming. Brian lived 2 houses down, and as she was waiting there, he walked out of the woods behind her cousin's house. He walked over to Bernadette, who was a pretty girl who he had never seen there before. He was instantly charming, and she was very curious about him. Up until this point of her life, Bernadette had never had any attention from guys, so this interaction was very exciting for her. She was from a family of 6 kids, so she didn't get a ton of individual attention from anyone. Her parents loved her, but in a house of 6 kids, there was always something else going on. Brian told Bernadette how beautiful she was, and that was the start of everything. She really liked him, so they quickly got together and became inseparable. It became an intense teenage love very quickly. Bernadette didn't care about anything else. She only wanted to be around Brian. He made it seem like nobody else in the entire world meant anything to him except her. She said, quote, "He was the first person to show me affection or love. He was my first kiss, sexual encounter, my first everything. He would visit her at the restaurant she worked at and write her love notes and letters constantly that started with, 'Hello, beautiful. I can't stop thinking about you. You're the most wonderful girlfriend. I love you so much.' Followed by 8 X's and O's and a heart." Bernadette knew very early on that she wanted to spend the rest of her life with him, and he made it clear that that's what he wanted as well. But things were far from perfect. There had been signs that Brian may not be as loving and soft as he initially appeared to be. Brian had been living with Bernadette's brothers in New York in 1995, and he caught them smoking marijuana. And because of that, Brian lost his mind. He ended up breaking one of her brother's noses and the other's legs, both of them. He thought they were bad influences on their sister, and they needed to learn a lesson. Brian forced her brothers into a car and picked up 17-year-old Bernadette and her friend. Bernadette got into the passenger seat of the car, and looking back at her boyfriend, she immediately noticed his eyes. They were blank, angry, and hollow, as if nothing else mattered. She said, quote, "He elbowed my brother's nose with us in the car, and he had a knife to my other brother's throat. That's the first violence I had ever seen." This was a very intense introduction to Brian's anger. This wasn't just Brian getting angry at a bar because another guy was flirting with her and punching him in the face, which would still be a red flag, but that's something you could almost write off. Brian had broken her brother's noses and legs and was holding a knife to their neck, and his eyes seemed almost demonic as he did it. This was a whole other level. After the incident, he sat down on the front porch with Bernadette. Bernadette recalled, quote, "I ended up on his lap because he was crying. He said, 'I didn't mean for it to get out of control, but the drugs are so bad for you. I'm a bad person. Can you love me anyway?'" Bernadette did love Brian, and she claimed this was the first time she realized how much he needed her, and she felt like she could fix him. But her brothers, who vehemently disapproved of their relationship, had been assaulted, and they pressed charges. Once the police were looking for him, Brian left New York and hid in Canada. And while he was away, he wrote Bernadette lengthy letters and often brought up the subject of marriage. Bernadette still loved Brian and wanted to be with him forever, but told him he needed to clean up his act first. And when he returned, he turned himself into the police for assaulting her brothers. Bernadette helped him find a lawyer, and he was eventually put on probation. Bernadette's mother said, quote, "She was so in love with him, and I knew no matter what we said, there was no tearing her away from him. I knew I had to wait for her to reach out to me when it came to Brian." Bernadette's mother had also been a victim of domestic violence, so she knew how this kind of thing went. And she even helped Bernadette find Brian a lawyer, which her sons were not happy about. Bernadette and Brian moved into an apartment together while she finished high school in Honesdale, Pennsylvania, near the New York state border. She was 19 years old, and he was 21 when they got married on June 22, 1997. But by that point, Bernadette was already carrying a dark secret for Brian. One day, as the two were walking in 1996, Brian stopped Bernadette and told her he had something really terrible to tell her. Brian had killed a man the night before. Although Bernadette heard what he said, she didn't really believe him. She didn't think the man she loved would be capable of doing that. Sure, he had a temper and could be violent at times, but he wouldn't kill someone. Brian didn't go into detail about anything, nor did he give her any explanation. He told her he had killed someone and that he loved her, so he wanted to be honest. He then told her, "I'm a bad person. Can you ever love me? Can you forgive me?" Bernadette told him something along the lines of, he would never hurt someone, and not to talk like that, and she did love him. She wouldn't have fallen in love with him if he was a bad person. When Bernadette later reflected on this moment, she said she really didn't understand what he was telling her and didn't believe that it was possible.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That 2-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players' $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
60-year-old Demetrius Carter had been found dead in the basement of Brian's parents' home in Sullivan County, New York, on March 1, 1996. It was 2 days after his father reported Carter as missing. Brian's parents would take in people with illnesses who needed help, and Carter was an AIDS patient. Bernadette had convinced herself that Brian didn't mean what he had said, but around that time, the police were considering Brian a suspect in this active murder case. She knew there was an investigation going on and that somebody had to have done it, but she really didn't think that it was him, even though he had confessed to her. And that strong denial and belief that Brian was innocent was only reinforced when Brian walked away from this investigation free and clear. The police had given him a lie detector test, but nothing ever came of it. Eventually, the investigation was dropped, and they were able to move on as if nothing had ever happened. And Bernadette was able to put this whole misunderstanding behind her. Brian was never charged with anything, and Bernadette still didn't see him as a bad person. She saw him as a man who loved her, and she felt the same. But as in love as Bernadette was, she claimed Brian was controlling from the start. He gradually became verbally and emotionally abusive before he physically hurt her. Not long after they were married, she sensed that he was cheating on her, and in 1999, she moved to Florida with a friend without filing for divorce or separation. Brian eventually followed her, and they were attempting to reconcile when she became pregnant. But about 6 months into the pregnancy, things still weren't working. She suspected Brian was taking drugs at that time, saying, quote, "He started staying out all hours of the night, but I got pregnant, and that was our new beginning." All Bernadette ever wanted in life was to have a family. She wanted that American dream. She wanted to be a good wife and to have children, which it seemed like Brian wanted as well. But when she became pregnant, he told her she rushed and purposely got pregnant and trapped him into this life. At that time, Bernadette still stood up to Brian, saying, "If you're not more supportive, I'm going to leave you." And in response, Brian bought Bernadette a bus ticket and left it on the table. So she took it and left for New York. At that point, their relationship was on the rocks, and they were separated. However, the week before Bernadette had their daughter, Brian showed back up and said, "I love you. We can make this work, and I'm about to have a baby, so I want to make it work. Bernadette's water broke on February 24, 2000. She and Brian had gone to visit Brian's foster mother. But when they arrived late for their visit in New York, it made her upset. And as a result, Brian became upset. Bernadette recalled, quote, "He hit her, threw her on the floor, and they were wrestling on the floor. My water broke. I didn't recognize that it was my water. She kicked us out. Here we are with our bags. My water just broke, and we're standing out in the street with nowhere to go." The next day, she gave birth to their first child in New York. Half of their belongings were still in Florida, but family members in Michigan offered help. They had $1,500 and a Jeep Wrangler and a U-Haul when they moved to Michigan in 2000. They moved to a home in Battle Creek, Michigan with family before they found an apartment of their own in Richland. At first, Bernadette felt like she was living the dream. She and Brian were finally living the white picket fence kind of life. They had two kids and a dog, and Brian was a great father at first. In the early days of their marriage and parenthood, Brian seemed to be the happiest Bernadette had ever seen. But then Brian hatched a plan to burn down the Battle Creek house to obtain insurance money so the Sugrims could buy their own home. Bernadette said, quote, "It was the first time he said it. You're not supposed to know about this, and if you ever talk about this to anyone, I will kill you and everybody else." It was the first time that Brian had ever threatened Bernadette's life, although she didn't necessarily believe he would do it. After the fire, they used the money to move into a house on Olcott Street in Kalamazoo. The couple was constantly struggling with money. Brian never kept a job for long. The longest job he had lasted 3 years, but he flip-flopped a lot between employment. Bernadette's job was the only reliable source of income, and she was the one that paid the bills. However, regardless of that strain on her, she said, "I couldn't discuss any financial worries with him because it would be my fault." In 2001, Brian's brother, Anil Christopher Sugrim, was killed in a motorcycle accident, and Brian had been very close with his brother, so he was deeply affected by his death. Brian at some point even expressed his wish that he died in place of his brother, saying, "I'm the evil one. He's the good one. I've done awful things." Brian was originally from Guyana and was not a legal citizen, so he went on to steal Anil's identity once he passed away. He even went as far as making false passports and other falsified documents. And after his brother's funeral, Bernadette began finding piles of empty peppermint schnapps bottles that Brian had attempted to hide. She later figured out he was also using drugs because he was so depressed. Bernadette had attempted to get help for her husband, but he refused to see a psychologist. Bernadette said, quote, "For the first 10 years of our marriage, I felt like I was put into his life. It was my responsibility to make him a better person. I thought my love would be enough to break that. It bothered me for a long time that I wasn't able to do anything for him or change him." And it wasn't all bad. She said there were good times during their 14 years of marriage. He would take their daughter on long bike rides when she was a toddler, and Brian's obsession with intelligence definitely rubbed off on their two children. His children and wife's intelligence was of the utmost importance to him. Bernadette said, quote, "He's always been intelligent, so the kids had to uphold intelligence. I can't say it's bad. They're smart kids. It wasn't until they were in grade school that it got overwhelming, but as toddlers, he was always teaching them. He would let them paint the walls. He'd take them to museums, art exhibits, and symphonies. But as time went on, things began to change. Brian started getting extremely angry out of nowhere, even more so than before. It was as if his anger would get flipped on and off like a switch. And it wasn't long before Bernadette began fearing her husband for the first time. He would corner her and scream in her face over something as simple as a fingerprint smudge on the television screen. If things weren't exactly how he wanted them, he would go ballistic, and his standards were extremely unrealistic. Looking back on her relationship with Brian, Bernadette said she can now see the red flags so clearly, and she doesn't know why she couldn't see them and get out of there sooner. But at the time, she couldn't see anything other than the fact that she loved her husband and family more than anything else in the world. But Brian began getting very angry with Bernadette over her intelligence. If she messed up a word or used the wrong grammar, he would blow up at her. She never knew what would set him off, but it happened very frequently. On one occasion, Bernadette had been on the phone talking to a friend in a completely other room from Brian. And after she hung up, Brian came into the room and told her she had answered the phone in the wrong way. That was what caused him to blow up that day. She couldn't even answer the phone right. These confrontations would be so severe, Brian would corner her and scream in her face things like, "I really want to take your head and bash it against the wall and watch the blood run down." All of that over how she answered the phone. Bernadette would try to de-escalate the situation or tell Brian the neighbors would hear him. But he would tell her things like he didn't care if the neighbors heard, let them hear and call the cops. He'd get into her face and tell her to never disrespect him like that again, because the next time he wouldn't be so nice. Brian's rage began getting more and more frequent, and Bernadette had no way to predict what would set him off. These arguments over nothing would happen about every other day, with Brian screaming in Bernadette's face and threatening her. And these screaming episodes would go on for 2 to 3 hours at a time. He would scream at her about everything she was doing wrong for almost hours every single night. And Bernadette didn't know what to do. She had no choice but to sit there and let him rant. The more she let him get it out of his system and appeased him, the better off she knew she would be afterward. If she didn't interrupt, it would end quicker. Every day, Bernadette was walking on eggshells around her house. Her anxiety became so bad she couldn't eat. She could just look at him and know he was in a mood, and today was going to be bad. And soon, Brian's anger became more and more violent. But the physical violence started in a way that could have been explained away at first. On Monday nights, Brian decided he was going to teach his family to box and learn martial arts for their safety, or so he claimed. He told his family he wanted them to know how to defend themselves, so Monday nights were reserved for training. And it wasn't just boxing. He taught his kids and Bernadette how to use a knife to defend themselves or how to shoot a gun. And at first, Bernadette thought this was a good thing, that their kids would know how to defend themselves if need be. But over time, it became clear that Brian was using these training sessions to abuse them. The training sessions became a mandatory thing for Bernadette and for the kids. Every Monday night, they would put on their boxing gloves and a padded helmet, and they would physically fight each other for 3 hours straight. At the end of those 3 hours, Brian was either happy with what they had done or he was extremely angry, and he was rarely happy. He didn't care that he was hitting his wife so hard it left bruises. Bernadette knew she had to do as much fighting as he wanted. She had to take it, otherwise it would be worse for her in the long run. And that also went for the kids. He forced the kids to fight each other, and they were not allowed to go easy. He told them if they took it easy on each other, he would punch them instead. And after a while of the violence staying within the bounds of training, it soon bled out into other times. The first time Brian hit Bernadette outside of their boxing nights, it was because Bernadette missed a call from him on her cell phone. He had gotten his family's cell phones, and Bernadette had never had one before, so she left it in her purse and hadn't heard it ring, so she missed a call from Brian. When he came home, he cornered her, pushed her up against a wall, and screamed in her face about the cell phone. And then he started hitting her over and over and kicking her in the legs until Bernadette fell onto the floor. He continued screaming about how she could only ever mess things up, and it was time for her to start living up to his standards or he would kill her. He told her he could easily kill her and get rid of her and make it seem like an accident. He even pulled her into the yard with a gun in his hand, and Bernadette for the first time thought Brian might actually kill her. But after one of these explosions, Brian would say things like, "I love you, and I'm sorry, and we can work this out." Those moments of supposed remorse and apology were extremely hollow, because they'd be followed by another instance of dragging her out of the driveway, pushing her to the ground, and choking her as he said, "I'll kill you right here. Go ahead and scream so the neighbors can hear." Once again followed by him getting soft and telling her how sorry he was and that he loved her.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the states in the Bluffmobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on SpinQuest. They have over 1,000 games, including live dealer, blackjack, and craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
But Bernadette was terrified of Brian at this point. Even when he was apologizing, he still managed to say that everything was her fault, but that they could get past this. And that's how it always was. Everything always tied back to how it was Bernadette's fault, even when he was apologizing. And yet still, through it all, Bernadette still managed to hold on to the idea that he would never kill her because he loved her too much. But eventually, Bernadette learned she might be wrong about that. One night, she was woken up and discovered she was staring down the barrel of a shotgun. Brian was standing to the side of the bed, holding the shotgun to Bernadette's head. She had no idea what was going on. She had just been sleeping, but Brian told her to get out of bed. She tried to tell him to stop, but there was no pulling him out of it at this point, so she just did as she was told. Brian led her out of the room and sat her down at their table in the dining room. And as she sat there, he paced back and forth with the gun, periodically pointing it at her as he yelled. He went off on this speech about how she wasn't doing anything right, and if she did what she was supposed to do, he wouldn't be doing this right now. She sat there wondering what she had done to set him off to the point that he would wake her out of her sleep and hold her at gunpoint. But none of these fits of rage and confrontations ever made any sense, so there would never be any logical explanation for why this was happening. This was the first time that Bernadette ever really felt afraid for her life. However, the next day, he approached her and told her how sorry he was. He didn't mean to scare her like that, and he loved her so much. She was the best thing that ever happened to him. But from there, it only got worse. Bernadette had a dog named Athena, who she had raised from a puppy, and one afternoon, the dog ran out of the yard and Brian got mad. So he took the dog in the backyard in front of them and shot it in the head. And Bernadette was devastated, but she couldn't do anything about it. She knew if she cried or showed any emotion, Brian's anger would turn on her. Their children were still small, and they had to watch that. All he told them was, "This is what happens when you can't follow directions." Bernadette said, quote, "We all learned to do exactly what we needed to make it okay. When we made him angry, we knew how to adjust and fix it. We knew how to hide things so he wouldn't see them. We learned how to give each other the look so you don't get into trouble." Bernadette made sure the kids were out of the house before Brian woke up, because he easily irritated by the noise, and she would schedule school conferences for times that he couldn't attend. Before the kids left for school, they were required to complete various lessons in a notebook that their father kept by the door. He would keep track of them, and when he came home, he would make sure that there were no misspellings. If they had gotten wrong something he had covered before, they would get a beating. Every day, Bernadette would check these notebooks to make sure she couldn't find any mistakes, before he had a chance to see them, but he would always find something. His methods for disciplining the children began with 2 to 3 whips from a belt, and when they started to pull away, he would keep going. If they hid behind their mother, she would get whipped too. If she intervened, Brian would hit her. He trained them not to respond. So over time, nobody moved. He trained them not to respond. He would berate them, calling them every name in the book, followed by, "I love you, but that doesn't mean I don't mean what I said. I did hate you." And at times, what he said verbally hurt more than the hitting. It's safe to say things were dark in the Sugrum household, but they were only going to get darker. In 2003, Brian woke Bernadette up in the middle of the night for a second time. And this time, Brian had been out all night, and when he came home, he told Bernadette he had something very important to tell her. Once again, Brian told her he had killed someone, and Bernadette had a flashback to that afternoon when Brian had told her he had killed someone for the first time. This time, Brian told her more about what he had done. He told her he murdered a woman last night. He had stabbed a sex worker to death. That night, he had smoked crack cocaine and did methamphetamine with her before he had killed her. The first time he had told Bernadette he killed someone, she didn't believe him. But now there was no doubt in her mind that he was telling the truth, and she felt sick and terrified. But Brian told Bernadette she needed to do exactly what he told her to, and if she did anything different, he would kill her too. If she told anyone, he would kill her, and she knew he wasn't bluffing. He then went into the backyard and began burning some things that tied him to the crime, like the woman's clothes and his clothes. He then instructed Bernadette to drive him to the bus station and drop him off. If anyone asked any questions about where he was to tell them that they were having a trial separation. He wanted her to keep an eye on the news, and if anything came up, she needed to keep him updated on what was going on. And after Brian left, Bernadette learned more about the brutality of the murder on the news. And as a warning, it is extremely dark. A 39-year-old woman named Linda K. Gibson was found on September 13, 2003. Her body had been dumped in a field near a factory in the city's Millwood neighborhood. The woman had been severely beaten and stabbed. Her body had been provocatively posed, almost in a birthing position. Kalamazoo Department of Public Safety lab specialist Brett Appelgren said, quote, "Both sides of the upper thighs were heavily slashed, cut extremely deep. Once we removed the cement block, we could see her head had been smashed with that block and had been cut extremely deeply. This was rage." Investigators also determined the murder did not take place at the site where Gibson was found due to the lack of blood at the scene and the fact that it appeared the body was cleaned prior to her being discovered. Bernadette felt sick learning about what her husband had done, but she was terrified of him. And even though she wanted to go to the police so badly, she felt like she couldn't. Not only had he threatened her life if she said anything, but Brian was staying with her family during this time, and she knew he wouldn't hesitate to kill them to save himself. The whole thing ate away at her as she listened to investigators on the case plead with the public for anyone to come forward with information about this case. They didn't really have any leads, and the case was going cold. She thought about calling them all the time, but the fear she felt overrode any desire to do the right thing. Brian was gone for an entire month, and during that time, not an ounce of suspicion fell on him. And one day, once he felt the coast was clear, he came home unannounced. Bernadette had done what she was told. She had become so terrified of Brian, she felt paralyzed. She wanted to leave with her children, but she was scared of what he would do to retaliate. Brian then sent her to the sheriff's office in 2005 to get a license to purchase a handgun, because he was unable to. While she was sitting there in the sheriff's office, she saw a flyer with a picture of Linda K. Gibson with the word "unsolved" across the top. "If you know anything about this woman, please call." It was devastating. She desperately wanted to tell someone, but she feared the police wouldn't believe her. And if for some reason Brian was able to get out of it like he had the first murder, she would without a doubt be next. Up until then, Bernadette had managed to push everything down and live day to day without thinking about her family's secrets. But there was no hiding from Linda K. Gibson's face hanging on the wall in the Kalamazoo County Sheriff's Office. It was right in front of her, staring her down. She said, quote, "I had to stand there and get my license while staring at that, knowing I am buying a gun for the same person who took that life. I wanted to scream out, I knew who did it, but I knew I couldn't. It was awful." Not upsetting Brian had become a daily goal for her and her two children at that time, but as time went on, it only got harder. She thought about taking the gun she had gotten and shooting him. She told herself if things got too bad, she would use the gun, and at one point she even contemplated shooting him one morning as he was taking a shower because he wouldn't know it was coming. She'd be able to shoot him right through the glass and everything would be over, but then she decided not to. First of all, because then she would be a killer, and she didn't want that, but also she didn't want to leave her children without a father. As if now they had a father. They didn't have a father, they had an abuser, they had a captor, but not a father. But Bernadette was worried about it. And she knew that she would likely be arrested herself and probably sent to prison. Which I can't say with certainty wouldn't have happened. Because if she shot him as he was vulnerable in the shower, it would probably be hard to prove that there was a reason that she had to shoot him, especially because most of what he was doing, there was no real evidence of at this point. She might have been able to say, hey, he's the one who killed two people, and he's been abusing us, and the kids could have corroborated, so maybe she would have been okay with it, meaning she wouldn't go to prison, but it's hard to say. And it's not a small thing, or an easy thing, to take someone's life, so I don't blame her for being scared. But she did fantasize about it. In October of 2009, Bernadette had picked up Brian's family from the Detroit airport when she collapsed from a heart attack. She was 31 and had never previously experienced any heart problems. And yet here she was, clinically dead for 7 minutes and on a breathing machine for 4 days. She believes she had a heart attack due to the stress. And after this whole ordeal, Brian's sister left Bernadette a note in her dresser, begging her to leave him. She left this note while Bernadette was in the hospital, and she read it when she got home. Brian's sister also whispered in Bernadette's ear, "You need to leave him, he's killing you." And that was the last time she saw Brian's sister and mother ever again. Bernadette said this heart attack was her turning point. She could no longer live the way she was. She loved him, but she was no longer in love with him. And that was when she asked Brian for a divorce. At first, he agreed to think about it. Bernadette recalled, quote, "We discussed it as a family, and then he came back and said I was free to leave at any time, but the kids would stay with him." Bernadette decided she couldn't leave her children. And after Brian had told her she could leave, but she would have to leave the kids, He then changed his tune and told her that if she did leave, he would kill her. He told her that he killed that woman because of Bernadette, telling her, "She reminded me of you, and I couldn't kill you because you're the mother of my children, so I killed her. But my children don't need you anymore. I can kill you and make it seem like an accident, and they'll never know the difference."
Happy birthday, America. It's time to celebrate and play your favorite Las Vegas casino games by American-owned SpinQuest.com. What's better than fireworks and American pie? Hitting a blackjack in the palm of your hand, and you won't lose your fingers. Over 1,000 games, including slots and live dealers. And $30 coin packs are on sale for $10. SpinQuest.com. Buy American players for American players.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Bernadette truly believed that he was going to kill her and that now he was planning it. And that's when she wrote a letter. That letter was written so that in the event of her death, it would be revealed that her husband had threatened her life, had killed before, and had taken a fake identity, and was a danger to their children. It was all she felt she could do. She may not be able to face him in life, but she could hopefully take him down in death if it came to that. After she wrote this letter, she sealed it and gave it to a friend, who later testified in court that she received the letter but never opened it. At that point in 2010, Bernadette began sleeping with a loaded gun underneath her pillow every night. The couple's daughter began asking if they could leave her father, and Bernadette would tell her he is sick and he needed them, saying, quote, "I didn't know what to tell her beside from he's sick. I told her I'm scared and I don't know what to do. I told her if she ever felt like if any of us were in danger, she needed to run and get help." And that is heartbreaking, that this child is asking her mother to leave their father, and Bernadette's telling her, "We can't, he's sick. But if you ever feel like we need it, you should be the one to run and help us." That wasn't her job, that was Bernadette's job. It's definitely very complicated, and I'm not saying that it's simple to leave an abusive situation, because it is actually the most dangerous time to be in an abusive situation is when you're leaving it. That is statistically when the most people are killed in abusive situations. So I'm not claiming that this would have been an easy thing to do, but putting that on her daughter was unfair. May 16th, 2011 was a Monday, which meant it was training day. Bernadette and the kids were not looking forward to it. When Bernadette got home from work, she knew something was wrong as soon as she pulled into the driveway. Brian and her son Chris had been boxing in the driveway, and her daughter Sky was in the garage. And as soon as she saw her daughter's face, her heart dropped. She was looking at her mother with terror in her eyes. She didn't have to say anything. Bernadette knew what was going on. So she walked over to Skye and asked her if she was okay and what was going on. Brian immediately stepped between them and told her, "It's none of your concern." Brian had been angry at his daughter for not learning how to control their dog. She failed at many attempts. Brian then tied her to the dog and beat her with a martial arts stick. He hit her around 50 times, leaving black and blue gashes across her back. Bernadette tried to stop Brian from hitting her, which was when he grabbed her by the throat and told her, "Don't you think about it, I'll kill you right here." After the beating, Brian set his sights on Bernadette. It was her turn to box. But as she was boxing with Brian, she was watching Sky out of the corner of her eye, and she saw her 11-year-old daughter get up and run. Sky escaped from the Sugrum home and ran to their neighbor's home and told them what had happened, so they called the police. Brian, Bernadette, and their son were still training when they heard the police sirens approaching, and Brian knew exactly what had happened. Bernadette later said, quote, "She did what I couldn't do." When the Kalamazoo County Sheriff's deputies arrived, they asked, "Do you know where your daughter is?" and asked if everything was okay, because their daughter had run to the neighbor's house and asked them to call the police. Brian was able to turn on the charm and speak to them as if everything had been totally fine. But Bernadette stood there in a panic, knowing the moment those cops left, he would kill them all. This was the first time the cops had been called to their home, and he was not going to be happy about it. There would be no talking her way out of this or making it better. Bernadette said, quote, "That is the moment. That was the first time the police had been involved and knew about any of the abuse in our family. No one expected anything like that, and I knew the way Brian was. I knew he would never let us live with getting the police involved." So Bernadette finally said, quote, "I told the cop, if you don't take him into custody, he will kill us all before the night is through." And she also told them that he had murdered somebody and told her about it. Brian Sugrim was finally arrested for all he had done to his family, and for the 8-year-old crime that he had committed. It had been 8 years since he murdered Linda K. Gibson. That night, at the hospital where her daughter was being treated, Bernadette spilled the family's dark secrets to police. When she first talked to police, she told the lead investigator that her biggest fear was that there would be some loophole that would let him get out, saying, quote, "When I first talked to the lead investigator, I told him I'm terrified to say anything, because if he gets out, he will find me and kill me. He'll hunt down every member of my family, and he will torture them. I'd live in that fear forever." Eventually, she told them her husband had confessed to her several years earlier to killing Linda K. Gibson. She also shared with police Brian had also admitted to killing a man in his parents' house in New York State in 1996. Brian told her he had done it to frame his father. They weren't married yet, but this was around the time that he had beaten up her brothers, so she was already afraid of him, but she still loved him. Bernadette told police that she had nothing to do with this crime, but she had never told anyone about it until he had beaten her daughter. Bernadette also shared that it wasn't until 2000 that he told her more about this murder. He had actually pointed out where he had done it, saying, "This was where I killed the guy. I shot him in the head and wrapped him up." This time, he had told Bernadette it was meant to be his father, but then he said he knew this guy had AIDS and no life and it didn't matter if he lived or died. He just wanted to kill somebody. After Linda K. Gibson had been murdered, Brian had shown Bernadette where he disposed of her body and revealed some details about the slaying. But Brian Sugrim was finally arrested and charged, however, he pled no contest to assaulting his daughter. His trial began on February 8, 2012. Almost 40 people testified against Brian in his trial, including his daughter and Bernadette. During her testimony, Sky said, quote, "We had to do everything perfect, and we were always scared. We had to keep him happy, and we had to do whatever we had to do that. He would yell, curse, and say rude names to me and my mother. It varied on the situation. Little things would displease him, like not doing a lesson on Rosetta Stone or the dishes not being washed." The girl testified about her father's beating and other instances of abuse, such as witnessing two of their family dogs being shot in the head, Brian buzzing her head due to head lice, and being punished for not keeping her brother out of trouble. Sky also said he didn't tell us about Linda Gibson or Demetrius, the man that he murdered in New York. He did tell us that he killed people. Brian would tell his children if there was ever a problem, someone would need to be killed, and he would do that. He didn't tell his children that he had specifically killed Linda Gibson or the man in New York. However, he did tell them that he had killed people. So they were terrified of him too. They also believed that he would kill them. Bernadette described various times when her husband's behavior left her fearing for her life on the stand. She told jurors about her husband's confessing to committing not one but two murders, saying, quote, "He said he killed Gibson in the van. He said he stabbed her to death and that he bleached out the van and dumped out her body. There is no question that he stabbed her to death. He said he stripped her and dumped it by the old factories where we lived and left it there." Bernadette said she waited 8 years to tell the police about her husband confessing to the murder because of the daily fear in which her family lived. She also said she loved her husband and wanted to help him become a better person. She said the incident with her brothers was the first time she realized how much he needed her. It's a very bad way to look at that situation. Not, oh my God, this man is so violent and dangerous, I need to get away from him. But, oh my God, this man is so violent and dangerous, he needs to be fixed and I can do it. And on February 15th, a jury found him guilty of first-degree murder for killing Linda K. Gibson. At his April 9th sentencing, 35-year-old Brian Sugrim faced a mandatory sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole. And thank God, because that man should never, ever get out of prison, and he won't. This was the only outcome that could have happened that would ensure his family's safety. Bernadette feared at first that he would just be deported, and then he would find his way back and eventually kill them. She said, "I have no doubt he would find his way back." But thankfully, that would not be the case. He would be in prison for the rest of his life, and there was no chance he was getting out. Bernadette received 60 letters from Brian while he was behind bars. She wasn't sure how he continued to reach her, but the last letter came 3 days before his murder trial. But now that Brian is gone, Bernadette is the head of her household for the first time, and she immediately put her two children into counseling. It actually surprised her how well her son and daughter were doing. I'm very glad to hear that they were doing well with the counseling. I'm honestly not surprised that they were doing so well, because The man they were afraid of and had been abusing them all their lives was now gone. The threat was gone. I know that there are definitely wounds still there, but as far as day to day, they're not living in fight or flight. They still have plenty of things to work through and wounds to heal, but at least they weren't fearing for their lives. Bernadette also said, "I want them to remember the good things. I don't want them to completely shut their dad from their life. There are academics," he was pushing them on. "I fear that I'm not capable of holding that up. It sounds stupid. They are so smart, I wonder if I can teach them." It's honestly no wonder that Bernadette feels inferior to her husband because he spent the duration of their relationship making her feel like she was stupid and that she's incapable of doing anything right. So I really hope that Bernadette put herself into therapy and counseling as well because she also has so much to figure out and work through. At the time all of this happened, her son was 9 years old and her daughter was 11. And Bernadette worried that her son might internalize this idea that he's also evil because his father was. She said her son changed dramatically in the year following Brian's arrest, but he was healing. He still held on to a box of his father's things. And Bernadette encouraged him not to let go. She didn't want to break his spirit, saying, quote, "He was dad's little soldier. He did everything to please his dad. Until he finds another person to look up to in that same sense, that's always going to be there." And that is very difficult. I mean, he's 9 years old. That is a very, very formative time for a child. So this whole thing had to be very confusing for them and also sad. Because yes, he was their abuser, but he was also their father, and it is a very complicated situation. Bernadette said she hopes to eventually find a person who can show her kids, quote, what a good husband and father should be like. But she never wants to speak to Brian again. She also hopes that sharing her story gives other women living in similar circumstances confidence to speak up. Bernadette recalled meeting the jurors after the trial, and one of them referred to her as a hero, and that comment did not sit with her very well. She said, quote, "That's a rough thing for me to accept. I'm not a hero. I told the truth. In fact, I didn't do anything for 8 years. That doesn't make me a hero. My daughter is the hero. She went to the police. She got help. I felt stuck." And Skye is a hero. She was so unbelievably brave, not only when she ran to her neighbor's house and had them call the police, but on the stand. She was so brave on the stand and said, quote, "I know it happens to a lot more kids than it seems, and a lot of people are afraid to tell. I know I was. So I've been talking to family and friends about making people aware that they need to tell someone if things are happening to them." She also said being called a hero is overwhelming, but she said it makes her feel happy. After Bernadette told her son and daughter about the guilty verdict, her son's first response was to grasp his sister's hand and say, "I want to thank you for doing what you did that day and for being brave. Now none of us have to be afraid anymore." I'm so happy to know that this family is no longer living in fear. Brian Tsugram is a monster, and he is exactly where he needs to be. He should have been there a lot sooner. At least he's there now, and this family can be on their journey to healing. Their story is very dark from start to finish, and I'm just glad that they made it to the other side. And I really want to emphasize how much I think of Skye for doing what she did. It was not an easy thing for her to do at all, and it must have been terrifying in that moment to make the decision to stand up and run, not knowing what could happen. But she did it, and in turn, saved her family's lives. I also feel like this is a very clear depiction of the lesson, you can't fix them, and it's not your job to fix them. Looking back on it now, Bernadette has said that she can see the red flags that she missed in the beginning, but had she not had this idea of I can fix him, maybe she would have left him a lot sooner. I am, however, glad that she spoke up when she did, because in that moment she could have just frozen and not said anything and hoped that it would blow over, but she didn't. She chose to make the hard decision as well for the sake of her children. I wish it could have happened sooner, but I'm glad it happened at all. And that now this family gets to move on and hopefully be happy in their lives and find some peace. But I think that's all I really have to say about that for now. So why don't we move on to a bit of a palate cleanser and I can tell you something good. That way we can go on with our days as normal. My good thing this week is that I am getting to hang out with my dogs, or my parents' dogs, so I don't get to see them very often, and they're just so ridiculous. They're 3 Shih Tzus, and they're sassy and annoying and very needy, but also extremely cute and only want to be held and pet, and that's amazing. And I get to squeeze their little heads, lovingly, of course, and just sit with them and have a good time. So I'm just glad that I get to hang out with them this week. If you have a Shih Tzu, shout out to you. And also, shout out to every other pet owner, because we just love pets out here. I hope you also squeeze their heads in a loving way. For me. But anyway, thank you all so much for listening. If you would like to get access to all of our bonus episodes, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. If you would like access to even more bonus content for free, head over to Steph Today over on YouTube. I have a couple of videos out now and one in the works as we speak. If you or anyone you know has a story of survival or something crazy that's happened to you and you would like to share it with us and possibly hear it on an upcoming listeners episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. I post pictures of all the stories we talk about over on Instagram @notoday_podcast. We have a TikTok that is notodaypodcast and a Twitter that is notodaypodcast with a T on the podcast is a 3 because that makes sense. And just keep breathing. Yeah.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.